When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
I bet you're smart.
Yeah, and you like to hold your own in the group chat.
We can help you drop even more knowledge. My name is Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Izadi. We host a daily news podcast called Post Reports.
Every weekday afternoon, Post Reports takes you inside an important and interesting story with the kind of reporting that you can only get from The Washington Post.
You can listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. Go find it now and hit follow.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Hi, I'm Ethan Nadelman, and this is Psychoactive, a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. Psychoactive is the show where we talk about all things drugs. But any views expressed here do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Protozoa Pictures, or their executives and employees. Indeed, as an inveterate contrarian, I can tell you they may not even represent my own. And nothing contained in this show should be used as medical advice or encouragement to use any type of drugs. Hello, psychoactive listeners. Well, today's episode is fairly close to my heart. It's on the subject of jazz and drugs and race and the Beats. My guest today is Martin Torogoff. He's an award-winning journalist and author. He's a documentary filmmaker. He's an Emmy-nominated television writer, director, and producer. He's got two books of great relevance to the subject and also to my life. The first one was a book called Can't Find My Way Home, about America and the Great Stoned Age, 1945 to 2000. And we'll talk about that a little bit, but we're really focusing on a book that he published a few years ago called Bop Apocalypse: Jazz, Race, the Beats, and Drugs. So, Martin, thank you so much for joining me today on Psychoactive.
Thank you for having me, Ethan. It's always interesting and fun to talk to you.
I think when we think about the origins of jazz and drugs, and especially marijuana, there's no place to start but with Louis Armstrong. So yes. Louis Armstrong and marijuana, Martin, talk about Louis Armstrong, how special and incredible he was, and his connection to marijuana.
What always fascinated me about this subject was that marijuana appears on the streets of New Orleans at just around the same time that jazz begins to percolate. So they were always there together, and it was always a kind of symbiotic relationship from the very beginning, like you're talking around 1910, 1911. So by the time, Armstrong is a teenager in New Orleans, that entire culture has been just beginning to really coalesce in a very significant way. What happens is that the artists begin making their way up the Mississippi River to Chicago. And in a way, the marijuana follows them. So in a way, you can like follow the story of marijuana and jazz together with Louis Armstrong up to Chicago, where it begins to blossom at the Lincoln Gardens with his creativity up there. And then it goes down to Kansas City. It goes across to Harlem. And that's really the beginning of it. So Louis fell in love with jazz and fell in love with weed. I mean, jazz came first. He did not turn on until he got to Chicago. And all of the musicians of the time talk about his love affair with it.
So he's this powerful figure. But marijuana, I mean, was there any way in which marijuana was a negative in his life, or was it all positive?
Not in his life. Not in his life. And he would talk openly about, you know, the many ways that he characterized it as a positive impact on his life. One of the really amazing things about looking at all of these jazz artists, the many different ones and their journeys through the use of different substances, is how from the very beginning you can see people who were able to use it in a positive way and set boundaries about it, and those who weren't, who had a very different kind of relationship with the substances that became problematical. Really, the difference between use and abuse in its very kind of organic application.
Right, but with marijuana, it typically was not a negative in the way, whereas heroin became a very much more mixed story in subsequent decades, right?
Yes. Absolutely. It wasn't like he was a propagator, a proselytizer for it, because that wasn't the case, but he was just honest about it. And, he believed that it was positive. To a lot of people, his relationship with it always kind of embodied his kind of genial, live and let live kind of attitude about life, his kind of enjoyment of things. He was a really beautiful man. You sort of look back and you look at his smile. He had a philosophy of life that was really positive. He had a philosophy of America that was really positive. And his relationship with the weed was really very much embroidered into that philosophy.
I remember one time meeting somebody who had been in charge of his USIA, U.S. Information Agency tour in Africa, maybe in the late 50s, early 60s. And I remember describing to me what it was like, because he was not going to travel anywhere without his weed. And she had to make sure that that was not going to be a problem as they crossed borders. But he was determined. And in a way, it was a small world around him that I think made sure Louis Armstrong was not going to spend another day in jail, even though marijuana was part of his everyday life experience.
Yes. He was literally the first celebrity marijuana bust in American history. It happened in Los Angeles, and he was actually set up. And when he came back to Chicago, he was really worried that it was going to have a negative impact on his career. And it didn't. And the reason that it didn't was because by that time, the people who were listening to jazz were really beginning to coalesce into a whole culture, into a viper culture, in Harlem, around places like, the Savoy Ballroom. And it was more widespread. I mean, it certainly wasn't, a mainstream thing, obviously. That didn't happen until, the mid to late 1960s and 70s. But there were enough people who were, listening to jazz, going to see jazz, buying jazz records, who were aware of marijuana, and, they weren't going to hold that against them by any means.
I think you write in your book that he sat down and he wrote a letter to President Eisenhower telling him that marijuana should be legal. So he was inhibited about expressing his views on that thing,
No, he wasn't inhibited at all.
So the question that rises with marijuana is, why the connection between marijuana and jazz? I mean, at one point you quote Norman Mailer as saying he couldn't think of one without the other. But for the musicians themselves, what was it that made it that made marijuana special?
Well, for one thing, it was just there, you know, and it was just a part of their lifestyle. I think it was Dexter Gordon, the great saxophonist, who called jazz lifestyle as music. And by the same token, you could call the Beat Generation lifestyle as literature. And marijuana was an integral part of that lifestyle. So it was just there. And from the very beginning, it was obvious to the people that smoked it and played the music that, you know, there were aspects of the marijuana experience that resonated powerfully and creatively for them in playing it, mm-hmm. in playing it alone and in playing it with each other, so that it became a part of the experience of performing it, and it became part of the experience of recording it.
Well, you know, in the book, I mean, you talk about some of these. I mean, it was all subtle and nuanced, and as you say, interwoven, and the causal relationships are hard to identify, but that sometimes marijuana gave some players a sense of courage if they were a young musician coming up and able them to just feel that much more confident, which would shape their jazz because feeling confident was better in performance than not. And you talk about maybe it helped to reduce inhibitions and therefore, you know, led to greater improvisation and experimentation. You talked about some of these writers saying that they could actually, it wasn't they played better, but that they could hear better, hear one another better, right? I mean that element, never mind the fact that it was preferable to all the other psychoactive substances like alcohol and heroin, which we'll get into shortly, in terms of one's health and not giving people a hangover and staying healthy for a lifetime.
You know, there are so many different opinions about it. I mean, for example, John Hammond, who was, you know, like a major figure in the jazz culture of that era in terms of like producing the music. He hated the presence of weed in the lifestyles of the musicians because he mm-hmm. felt that, well, for one thing, it made them liable for persecution, but also he felt that it played havoc with their sense of time. And a lot of musicians would disagree with him about it. I mean, he wasn't a smoker, so he wouldn't have known. You know, at one point, I was reading something that Charles Baudelaire wrote about the effects of hashish. You know, Charles Baudelaire, the French poet. Mm-hmm. He called it a mirror that magnifies, yet only a mirror. And I found that to be very, very useful in considering the relationship between, you know, the substances and the musicianship. These musicians were all unbelievable artists. They were disciplined. They practiced endlessly. You know, their entire lives were devoted to their art form. And I don't think that marijuana, you know, in and of itself, you know, made any of them innately better musicians. You know, it couldn't like put talent there that wasn't already there. But what it could do was it could amplify that talent in different ways. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think the answer is like somehow contained in that kind of thesis.
I'll tell you that even today, when I find myself now, as things are opening up post-pandemic, I find myself going to jazz clubs in New York more and more frequently. And one thing I like to do is to like take a little 5-milligram edible before I go. And it just enhances the appreciation and especially my ability to appreciate some of the more out there improvisation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thoughts?
I think you hear it over and over again. I mean, I think it just opens your musical mind. There's just something about it. Mez Mezro, there was a musician who fell in love with the blues, fell in love with weed, and he...
And was himself a jazz... I mean, what, did he play clarinet or something?
Yeah,
I mean,
he was a clarinetist. But there, mm-hmm. in his book, Really, the Blues, there is a passage in which he describes the first time that he ever smoked and went out on the bandstand to play. And to me, it's one of the most resonant pieces of writing that I've ever come across about, you know, the potential of taking a musician's mind or a listener's mind and just kind of like opening it. It's really a remarkable piece of writing. If you want, I'll read you a little passage of This is him going out to play under the influence for the first time. The first thing I noticed was that I began to hear my saxophone as though it were inside my head, but I couldn't hear much of the band in back of me, although I knew they were there. All the other instruments sounded like they were way off in the distance. I got the same sensation you'd get if you stuffed your ears with cotton and talked out loud. Then I began to feel the vibrations of the reed much more pronounced against my lip, and my head buzzed like a loudspeaker. I found I was slurring much better and putting just the right feeling into my phrases. I was really coming on. All the notes came easing out of my horn, like they'd already been made up, greased and stuffed into a bell. So all I had to do was blow a little and send them on their way, one right after the other, never missing, never behind me, all without an ounce of effort. The phrases seemed to have more continuity to them, and I was sticking to the theme without ever going tangent. I felt like I could go on playing for years without running out of ideas or energy. And that's it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. At one point, you know, you talk about Allen Ginsberg, the great poet, the one who wrote the poem Howl, which is, you know, perhaps the most famous poem written in America in the mid-20th century, or maybe even the entire second half of the 20th century. But him being very influenced, not just by jazz, but by Mesro's book, that it was formative for him.
Yeah, he found it in the Columbia bookstore when he was a student at Columbia, you know, in the 40s. And he was very, very interested in experiencing marijuana. And that book was like the Rosetta Stone for him, because it showed him that it emerged from a whole cultural sensibility in the United States. And that really began his whole lifelong interest in learning about drugs, learning about their origins, learning about their cultural origins, understanding the spiritual connotations of them. You know, the Beats were so amazing because that's a literature in which the writers were imbued with the experiences of these substances at the same time as they were trying to find a new form that was like jazz. They were trying to write like the jazz musicians were playing. So you have a literature that's imbued and catalyzed by the experiencing of these substances, about these substances, in which you have writing for, you know, a popular audience really in this country for the first time about these substances. So it's groundbreaking from all of those different aspects.
Well, you talk in the book about, you know, some of these early, before they become famous, they're going up to the jazz clubs in Harlem and elsewhere. You talk about Lester Young, who we'll get to in a moment, you know, giving Jack Kerouac his first joint.
Definitely changed his life for sure.
Yeah, it did. It really did. Now, just to go back to the jazz for a second, just talk about Lester Young, nicknamed Prez. You know, him and the saxophone, to some extent, begin to redefine jazz in the 30s. And he's somebody for whom also marijuana is important in his life, although he's unfortunately caught up in other drugs, notably alcohol. I mean, I think at one point you say he may have been the most influential of all jazz musicians, which surprised me a bit. But explain why.
It was his style that was really so influential, as well as his unique musicianship. He was such a singular personality. You know, his background, he came from this band that this musical family, and he was very sensitive, and he was very devastated by his experiences of the racism of that time. He also was really, really in love with weed. What it did for Prez was it pulled him into himself, and it allowed him to create his own kind of insulated musical world in which he kind of became this very singular personality. So that was his impact. He drew people into that, like that little bubble that he wove around himself. And in that bubble was his incredible, fertile creativity, and also his sensibility, his unique sensibility. I mean, he really was the inventor of cool as it came to be known in the 30s and 40s and 50s. I mean, you can almost trace it back to this one individual in his demeanor, in how he walked and how he talked, his invention of jive, his use of these words that became like staples in the vernacular. I mean, he was so unbelievably inventive in every possible way.
We'll be talking more after we hear this ad.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having pink lady apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
You mentioned some of the expressions that he probably coined. I got it made. I got eyes for that. Copycat. Even the Big Apple is the nickname for New York. The word crib for one's home. The word bread for money. And would even end sentences of conversations by saying, you dig? I mean, and then, of course, the expression cool, as in that's cool, man. So once again, as with Louis Armstrong, whether they originated or popularized, but, you know, it was a formative influence on American culture, not just through their music, but even through their way of talking, of speaking, of creating new language.
Yeah. And also, it's interesting to consider, the impact of the weed on his musical style, because it was so emblematic, really, of his personality. He was kind of like very, very laid back in his tone. It was a very sweet tone. And he would just kind of like lay back. And then all of a sudden, just in the most tasteful way, just completely take over the music and just elevate it to this very, very unique place. And that was how people kind of saw him. He was kind of a very laid back guy. He was very shy. He was like a laggard, you know, he was just kind of like hang there and then like draw you in and then just take you somewhere. And his relationship with Billie Holiday was one of the, really signature creative relationships of that entire era in the music.
Well, we'll get into Billie Holiday shortly, but once again, to jump forward into the Beats, I mean, for Allen Ginsberg. Now, Ginsberg, you say, was strongly influenced by Lester Young. And notably, I think his songs, I Got Rhythm. Let's hear a little clip. And Lester Leaps In. Let's hear a clip. So, talk about that connection, Martin, between Lester Young and his influence on Allen Ginsberg.
Well, you know, Kerouac was the real jazz aficionado of the early Beats. And he, of course, who was turned on by Lester Young, you know, he started going to the jazz clubs, and he was the first one to write about jazz of those guys. And, you know, he and Allen were very close, and they would listen to the music together. And Kerouac was the first one who became imbued with this notion of writing the same way that the jazz musicians played. He would listen to Charlie Parker, and he would listen to Lester Young. And one of the things that he really began to see was that they played in these long lines, these kind of like long, unbroken lines, in which one idea would like initiate, like unleash another idea, and then another idea, and then another idea, in this kind of endless progression of unfolding of like ideas and melodies, and with, and there would be breaks, and then the breaks would be used creatively to kind of contextualize something else. And, you know, Kerouac would like get stoned, and he would listen to the jazz, and then he would like think about how he could, you know, write in the same way. So some of his earliest attempts of writing were, you know, like long improvisations, really. I mean, his whole creation of the manuscript for On the Road, for example, which he did like putting this giant roll of paper and putting it in a typewriter and just sitting down and like literally like 21, 22, 23 days straight, just like churning out this manuscript, which became this like incredible novel called On the Road. Allen, in his development in his poetics, was always looking at Kerouac and going, wow, 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 I wonder if I can do that with my poetry. Mm-hmm. And when he sat down, he was living in North Beach at the time in San Francisco, and he sat down to write Howl. Kerouac had been living in Mexico at that time, and he had created this long poem called Mexico City Blues. And he sent it to Allen, and Allen, you know, started writing Howl, trying to do it along that kind of like long saxophone line. And that's the entire first movement of Howl is written exactly. It was almost like he was trying to channel Lester Young, like sitting down and blowing. So the whole first movement of Howl is like, you know, him just like blowing on a saxophone, really.
You know, this brings us to the next great revolutionary in jazz, Charlie Parker, and bebop jazz. And Charlie Parker, as somebody who's using drugs from the time he's in his young teens, Charlie Parker, a man of fantastic appetites. Charlie Parker, who just keeps using more and more drugs and keeps getting more and more creative in his music until a breaking point comes. So, I mean, a lot of your book, obviously the title is Bebop Apocalypse. Charlie Parker was Mr. Bebop. Tell us about Charlie Parker and about the relationship between drugs and his music.
Well, he was unique because he was so musically driven and ambitious from a very young age. And also from a very young age, he was just as driven to use and abuse pretty much everything he could get his hands on. And he was a genius musician, you know, addicted for the first time as a teenager, even before he left Kansas City to, you know, hop the freight train that would bring him to Chicago and then eventually to New York and then eventually to fame. We talked extensively about Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong, lifelong user of marijuana, who set pretty strong boundaries about things that he would do and things that he wouldn't do. He, for example, did not like alcohol, and he wouldn't like cross that boundary into the use of alcohol. He really, really did not like hard drugs, and he never crossed that boundary into hard drugs. Charlie Parker, Bird, as he would, of course, become famously known, he not only had no boundaries about music, but he had no boundary about his use of substances. Not only would he use everything, but he would make an ethos of it. And he was so brilliant musically that that boundaryless ethos about his substances became inextricable from his, you know, just boundary-breaking musicianship and genius. So that's what set those two geniuses apart from each other mm-hmm. in terms of their relationship to substances. Mm-hmm. That's the best way I could describe it.
Yeah. You know, at one point you describe, there's a song, and let's hear a clip from it, Loverman. This song became part of the legend of his genius of Charlie Parker. Say something about Loverman.
You know, it's so interesting because he became an addict as a teenager. And then when he got really musically ambitious, he decided that he was going to get clean. So when he jumped that freight train out of the Kansas City freight yard and, you know, to begin his musical odyssey, he kind of understood that he needed all of his discipline and all of his energy towards that goal. And he kind of like, you know, he put down narcotics at that point. And then he came to New York and, you know, he hooked up with the small inner nucleus, you know, that would form the seminal bebop group, you know, that all played in Mittens in the, you know, the early to mid 1940s. And it was a small group of guys.
And Mittens was the jazz club around, what, 135th or 100?
Yeah, yeah. But it was a small subterranean setting up in Harlem, and all the, you know, like the musicians who were interested in exploring this new form of jazz would kind of gather there after their gigs. And Bird was one, and Dizzy Gillespie was another, Kenny Clarke, Max Roach on drums, and Thelonious Monk, you know, the great pianist, he was a part of that group. He really became the spark plug, like the creative spark plug of that new form of the music. And just as that was happening, he fell back into his use of narcotics and got really, really strung out. Strung out in a way that he had never been strung out before. So, like, right at the peak of that, he was playing in a group with Dizzy, and Dizzy decided that he was going to take his band out to the West Coast to showcase the music for the first time, at a place called Billy Berg's. And it was a big deal. You know, all the people who were in the know about jazz out there, they showed up because the buzz was about this new form and this guy Bird. And so he got to Los Angeles. It was a new place for him. He didn't know where to cop. And he immediately got in trouble. And he became extremely unreliable. Because he was always out scouring the town, looking for a fix. And that was when Dizzy decided, okay, you know, this is not working. He dropped him from the group, brought the rest of the group back to New York, and Bird was left out there in Los Angeles, high and dry, badly strung out. And he ended up living with the trumpet player, Howard McGhee. And it was McGhee who got Bird a deal with this guy, Ross Russell, to go in and have this recording session. And when he went in to record these songs, he was very, very, very badly strung out. And one of the songs that he recorded in that session was Lover Man, which had been a Billie Holiday song. And he played it, and he just, like, really, really on the edge. And he just, he did what he always did. He just went for it. And the track was recorded, and that was when Bird had his breakdown. You know, he goes back to the hotel, and he ended up in Camarillo in the mental institution there. And when he got out, that was when the track was released. And he came back to New York, and, you know, he was healthy again, and he formed this group. Miles Davis was a part of.
Well, wait, so that song Lover Man, then, even, I mean, he's just about barely can get it together, but it turns out to be one of his great recordings?
Well, he never liked it himself. He understood, you know, the kind of shape that he was in it when he recorded it. But the impact that it had on his musical community was powerful, because by then everyone kind of knew about his lifestyle. And he came, you know, out, and he went back to New York. He played at the Royal Roost, and his band just tore it up. He was like at the top of his game, and that's when really his legend began. And so this track comes out, and they hear this man who now everybody knows had been a junkie and is a junkie. And what they hear is this statement of this artist, like, essentially playing his pain. Mm-hmm. And they were terribly moved by it, just by the pathos of it and by his commitment to his art. And somehow the fact that he was a dope fiend, it just created this aura of this kind of dark romanticism, really.
At one point, Mark used this phrase, I don't know, you're quoting somebody else, but saying that with the heroin, I mean, and everything else that was going on, and it wasn't just heroin, because Charlie Parker and many of the others, they were using a lot of stuff. They were sometimes, there was a lot of alcohol. Sometimes alcohol was the dominant drug. There was weed, of course, but there were also benzedrine. There might have been other stuff. But in some level, they were playing their lifestyle, I think you put it that way, for better or worse. And, you know, you describe another moment, too. I think it's 1946. Norman Granz, the jazz producer, is putting on jazz at the Philharmonic. And Charlie Parker's supposed to be there. He's trying to score, finally shows up. And I think the song was Sweet Georgia Brown.
Yeah. Yeah.
What happened there?
He comes on stage and blows everybody away.
Let's hear a clip of that. So that and the rest of it blew people away that evening, huh? And he was totally high as a kite, but pulling it together.
Well, the thing that people don't really get about, heroin is that these guys were not shooting dope to get high and go on stage and play. If you shot dope, you would go on the nod. That's not really where they wanted to be when they played. What heroin did was it made them what they called straight. They called it getting straight. It kind of stabilized them, really. That's one of the misconceptions that, you know, people have about heroin and jazz is that, you know, when these guys were addicted, you know, they would shoot dope and like, you know, get on the stand and like be high out of their minds and play. No, that's not what was going on. What was going on was that this drug, which had created this metabolic need for it, was being satisfied. And so that's what would allow them, you know, the kind of stability, be anchored, you know, back again in their music, in their creativity.
You remind me, Martin, of years ago, I read the biography of Stan Getz, who was the great white jazz saxophonist. And what it described in there was his addiction to two drugs, heroin and alcohol. But its story it told was that alcohol was the drug that turned him into an asshole and that screwed up his playing and messed up everything, you know, in his life. That with heroin, it wasn't the drug itself. It was the need to score, to find a place to score, to get the money together, to find a place to use, to do all that, and then get to his gig in time. And it was, to some extent, not the drug, but the illegality of it, the criminality of it, which might have been, in some respects, part of the enticement for a whole bunch of rebellious personalities who were pioneers in jazz, but that was also the destructive, harmful element of it. And I think what you described about Charlie Parker as well, right? Another point you described, there's another a protege of Charlie Parker, Jackie McLean, who I think was one of your key sources because he was still alive and available when you're writing this book. And I think you quote Jackie McLean saying, you know, heroin was kind of a working drug.
For a lot of them it was. I mean, you know, it's very complex when you think about it. I mean, these were brilliant musicians, highly evolved, highly sensitive people, devoted to this art form, devoted to like really pushing it. And a lot of them believed that, you know, it had not only creative capacity, but sociocultural, racial ability to bring people together. And yet the irony was that it was making them vulnerable to prosecution. And the element of racism, you know, of course, not all the musicians were African-American, you know, a lot of them were. And the whole role that heroin played in as an anodyne to the racism of that time and what these people had to endure is also a significant factor, I believe. So they were all very different people having different experiences. And in Jackie's case, who's a wonderful man, by the way, it took him 25 years to get clean. And he would never have been able to do it without methadone. And that was his bridge to, you know, getting clean from heroin, was through use of another opiate. So it was a very complicated thing.
I mean, just to give the audience here a sense of how pervasive this was, I mean, it really happens. I think the heyday of heroin and jazz is really from 1947 to 1957, give or take a few years here or there. But at one point, one of the famous jazz critics, Nat Hentoff, he goes to the Newport Jazz Festival of 1957, and he surveys over 400 jazz musicians from New York City and asks them about their drug use. And with marijuana, he finds, according to the people self-reporting, 82% say they've tried marijuana, 54% say they've used it occasionally, 23% say they do so regularly. With heroin, 53% said they tried it, 24% say they use it occasionally, and 16% say they use it regularly. And separately, there was another jazz historian, Lincoln Collier, who claimed he thought that up to 75% of all jazz musicians used heroin during the 1940s and 1950s. So this is a period when heroin was becoming a little more prominent in the Black community. And Claude Brown, in his famous book, Man Child in a Promised Land, writes about what happens in the late 40s and the 50s, where heroin does get take off. But the vast majority of the culture is not using it. So this really is a subculture of jazz greats and jazz great wannabes who are also using heroin. And of course, what many people put the blame on Charlie Parker, about how many musicians would listen to Charlie Parker play in a way that nobody had ever played before and that seemed almost impossible. And, you know, oh, it must be because he's shooting heroin. And if I become a heroin user, I can be more like my hero, Charlie Parker, and maybe I can play more like him. I mean, there's some truth to that, I guess, Martin, right? That people, you know, kind of either let down their guard vis-a-vis heroin or even went into it because Charlie Parker was the infamous heroin-using jazz great.
Yes. And he recognized that, and he was, like, deeply unhappy about it. Byrd was a very complex human being. And, you know, that's one of the challenges of, you know, writing about people like Charlie Parker and Billie Holiday, these mythic figures who, you know, at the same time became addicts, and their myths essentially become their stories, you know. And as you mentioned, this is like happening on stage, but the backdrop is something that's happening, you know, to an entire community, really, up there in Harlem. You know, you mentioned Claude Brown writing about that at Manchild in the Promised Land. I had the honor of interviewing Claude Brown for my books before he passed away. And one of the things that really comes across is how these individuals, these artists, became really, really prominent and heroes, really, to the community up there. And, you know, their lifestyles became inextricable from their accomplishments as artists. So really what you have for the first time is a group of individuals who become role models for a phenomenon of heroin use in a community at large. Mm-hmm. A community that finds itself in the crosshairs, really, of forces in which, you know, the lives of these musicians is really just one thread, really, where so much else is going on, you know, about crime and public policy and racism and things like that. And that's when the whole thing becomes extremely complex and, in its own way, tragic.
Let's take a break here and go to an ad.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Parrot Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
You also bring out something else there, which was specifically about bebop. I mean, your book is called Bebop Apocalypse, and Charlie Parker is a key figure in it. And you talk about bebop music to some extent, kind of intersecting with heroin, but also it's the type of music that reflects and that manifests the feeling of resentment that so many Black people feel, especially after World War II, of people who had served in the Army in World War II, served in the military, coming back and then being thrown back into Jim Crow America and even the racism in the northern states. And then you have, of course, the great evil, you know, human being throughout all this period, Harry Anslinger, who becomes the founding director of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics in 1930 and rules that agency for 32 years until 1962, who is by all accounts a racist, right? And who somebody is initially focused on heroin, but by the mid-30s begins to focus on marijuana and the demon drug and the era of reefer madness and really conflating, you know, the whole fear of white women having sex with Black men and the role of drugs and music and all of that. So say more about bebop and racism and heroin and that interweaving of those elements.
Bebop was a revolution within the jazz community. It was a revolutionary kind of music. I mean, it evolved from swing, but it turned swing on its head, really. And there were people who hated it as a result of it, jazz critics and jazz musicians. So the music itself was considered to be subversive. And so on top of that, you have it being played by these individuals who were very, very aware of that and also aware of the fact that, you know, they were African Americans and that the music was, to them, they saw it as a vehicle to express, you know, their absolute awareness of and condemnation of the racist society that they lived in. A lot of the people who were jazz lovers of that time were very, very simpatico with that entire sensibility. Anslinger, from the very beginning, understood that this was a subversive culture, socially and racially. I mean, when he decided to, you know, conduct the entire anti-marijuana crusade, he was compiling a list of jazz musicians. And his idea was that with the marijuana law of 1937, he was going to go after all of these jazz musicians and basically, you know, throw them into prison. So from the very beginning, there was this sort of adversarial relationship between the jazz community and Harry Anslinger and the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. In a way, that's where the culture war over drug use in this country really, really begins. So it's couched in this racism from the very, very beginning. Mm-hmm. You have, you know, this phenomenon of, you know, what's called the Great Harlem Heroin Epidemic. You know, some people have a problem with the use of the word epidemic, but it's used to express the fact that you have for the first time, you know, this community, which is really, really suffering from addiction, heroin addiction, on a level that's never really been experienced before in American society. So while you have that happening, you have these laws being put into effect so that people who are addicted, there's only one thing that can happen to them, you know, them to be thrown into prison and buried, you know, for decades. At the same time, you have what is really the first popular movement to try to medicalize, to try to take heroin addiction and bring it back to the purview of, you know, people in the medical community.
You're reminding me, I should say also, Martin, you know, at the beginning of this thing, I wanted to actually, for the first time ever, dedicate an episode of Psychoactive to somebody. And that person is Dr. Professor John P. Morgan,
who
was a professor professor at City College. He taught the mixed undergraduate, graduate medical program there. But he was one of the America's great drug experts, the one who coined the term opiophobia. He was probably the most frequent expert witness on drug cases for the defense in America. But he was also an extraordinary ethnomusicologist who had a library of thousands of songs, and also somebody who had a like audiographic memory where he actually had in his head the lyrics of thousands of songs that had drug references in them. He passed away at a fairly young age, but I would like to dedicate this episode to him. And I know you mention him in your book. You acknowledge his role in helping inform you as you were writing about this.
Yeah, he was an amazing man. I mean, I'm very grateful to you, by the way, for when I really, really started delving into the whole subject of drug culture, you know, that ended up in, you know, my two books and the various documentary and television series I've done, of opening up that whole network of those people who had a huge impact on me. And he was certainly one of them. I mean, he was a great lover of jazz. And he was incredibly knowledgeable about it. And at the same time that he was like so obviously incredibly knowledgeable about drugs from a scholarly and medical point of view, at the same time that he was aware of, you know, the sort of cultural dimensions of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really appropriate that you would dedicate this episode to him.
Yeah. To John, to Dr. John P. Morgan. So, Martin, you know, just going back, so we get into the 50s and Miles Davis, who becomes a key figure, has his band John Coltrane. And John Coltrane, who really of all the jazz greats is the one that has the most personal impact on me. But I noticed in writing, you know, Coltrane goes through this terrible period of heroin and alcohol really messing him up in a significant way. And he then finally goes through this experience that he describes as a spiritual awakening, where he puts it all behind him. And that unleashes, you know, one of the most extraordinarily creative periods in the history of all of jazz. But I noticed in reading about this that you wrote about John Coltrane's transformation, and there was something personal in it. I don't know if you specifically said it in the book, but I remember when you came to see me, you said, Ethan, you know, I'm somebody who's had my struggles with drugs and had to, you know, put them behind me, but I'm also somebody who gets it about all the positive ways that drugs play in life. So what, to just explain a little more from a personal side, how the story of John Coltrane's spiritual awakening as he comes, leaves his heroin addiction and alcohol addiction behind him, what it meant to you?
Well, I mean, I come to this subject as someone who pretty much crashed and burned on drugs and had to, you know, get clean and sober at the age of 37. And initially, my whole interest in this subject became about trying to understand its impact on me and trying to sort it all out. And then I began to sort of think about, okay, what was its impact on my generation? And then I began to think about, well, what was its impact on my country? And in my experience of recovery, of the recovery culture, you know, I was kind of thinking about, you know, what Bill Wilson had to say, you know, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, and his correspondence with the great Swiss psychiatrist, Carl Jung, in which they began to postulate about how what they call the spiritual awakening could transform the landscape of the addict and the alcoholic, and how that was, as they saw it, like the most beneficial, the most advantageous, that would kind of like give the addict and the alcoholic the best shot at, you know, living a different life that was not consumed by the destructive impact of these things, by addiction and all the kind of side effects of being addicted to whatever it was that you're going to be addicted to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I really began to look at the transits of these different musicians through addiction, what really, really leapt out at me was Coltrane's experience and him directly referring to what happened to him leaving heroin behind as a spiritual awakening. Because what happened to Coltrane was that he had tried numerous times to kick and he couldn't do it. But finally he reached a bottom and he went to, you know, sequester himself away. And he basically shut himself up in a room for a couple of weeks. And he told people, you know, only just bring me water. You know, I'm going to stay in this room and what's ever going to happen to me is going to happen to me. And at some point during the experience, and when he was suffering from the agony, the physical agony of withdrawal from heroin, of how he called out, he reached out to a higher power of his understanding and asked for help and asked for this terrible experience to be lifted, to be removed from him. And he writes about it. And he basically says that he experienced a peace, a kind of inner peace. And also at the same time, he asked his higher power to be able to use his gift, to use his art in a way that would spiritually uplift people. And that was his entire approach to his art. Mm-hmm. As he left heroin behind. So that when you were listening to that wonderful track, that amazing, his version of My Favorite Things, in which he picks up the soprano saxophone, in essence, what you were hearing is that love, that expression of that love, of that awakening that he would experience as a result of that. And it's really amazing because, I mean, Coltrane's music is actually used in, you know, the numerous churches, you know, the same way that the music of Bach and, you know, St. Matthew's Passion would be used in a church. And it's for a reason. It's because that music is just completely about his relationship with his higher power.
There's even a church in San Francisco still in existence. So it's, you know, in fact, it's funny. No disc of jazz and drugs without discussing a jazz musician who in the 1950s is described as, quote unquote, the most famous drug addict in America. And who is simultaneously one of the perhaps the greatest jazz vocalist in American history and global history, and that's Billie Holiday. I mean, somebody who, like Charlie Parker, struggles with all sorts of drugs, and although heroin's, you know, as with Parker, somebody for whom the drugs seem to have, I think, probably thinks and speaks politically about the war on drugs. So you have a lot about Billie Holiday in your book.
Yes.
And say something about her that stands out.
Oh, God, where to begin with Lady Day? Someone whose life was shrouded in myth from the very beginning.
Well, how about let's just hear a brief clip from her, one of her most famous songs, Strange Fruit.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root.
Strange Fruit was a song that Billie began performing at Cafe Society in the late 30s when she came down from Harlem to like really become just an absolute phenomenon, you know, in the first like really important downtown interracial jazz club. And, you know, I'm sure you know that it's a song about lynching. A guy by the name of Abe Meerpol wrote the lyrics, and her musical director there at Cafe Society gave it to her when she began performing it. And the thing about Billie Holiday that was so unique was here was someone who just instinctively understood how to take a composition and translate it, transform it, express it as a deeply personal, deeply moving piece of art and have that impact on the people.
Now, of course, it also had an impact on Anslinger. I think it's the first time he really becomes aware of Billie Holiday, because that, you know, is it's one of the really maybe the one of the earliest, if not the first, really great protest song against racial injustice.
Yes, yes, it was the first time that someone had used an art form, really a popular art form, to make a statement about lynching and racism in America. It was transformative, really. And yes, it was a bold political statement. Her record label at the time would not release it. She had to find another record label to release it. And yes, that was what brought her on the radar screen of Harry Anslinger, you know, of the FBI, of the New York Police Department. And of course, in her case, it would make her vulnerable to prosecution because of the fact of her relationship to drugs, specifically her heroin addiction. So from the very beginning, from 1946 on, she had to walk this tightrope, really, between her public legend and, you know, these forces that were going to use that to try to bring her down.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
You know, from very early on, she decided that one of the ways she was going to deal with this very difficult situation, this very dangerous situation, was she was just going to talk about it. And she was really one of the first people to do that. She was busted three times. And, you know, and each time, basically, she just like, you know, talked about it. And one of the things she talked about was what bullshit it was, you know, the fact that she was being hounded by the police. She was aware of the fact that she was a public figure. She was aware of the fact that she had these problems with addiction. She was aware of the fact that people were going to listen to what she said about it. And so that's what she did. And she talked about how she believed that it was more of a medical problem than a criminal justice problem. And that was anathema to what Harry Anslinger wanted to put across. To him, it was all about, you know, these people were weak, they were depraved, they were evil, they needed to be locked up. And anyone who expressed a point of view that was sympathetic to the idea that these people, they needed to be cared for, they weren't even allowing them in hospitals. It was illegal to allow a drug addict in Harlem to be admitted to a hospital. Yeah. Think about that. Until Billie Holiday in 1959 died in a hospital in Harlem.
But there are these moments, right, in the kind of mass media.
Billie Holiday had a really close friend. She was a dancer and a singer and an actress. Her name was Marie Bryant. And she said something really interesting. She said, people like Billie Holiday and Lester Young, they were real. And that reality, just how real they were, is what made them so vulnerable. You know, for people like that who are so just like so vulnerable, it just made it very, very hard for them. You know, there's a wonderful image that Bono puts forth about Billie Holiday in his song Angel of Harlem, which I think also kind of gets to that. When he sings, Lady Day had diamond eyes, she sees the truth behind the lies, you know? And I think that's what Marie Bryant was talking about.
Well, Mar, let me ask you this, you know, because you do, I mean, you know, obviously one key part of the question with race, and we've been talking about, you know, the ways in which racism, you know, was one of the reasons why so many of these musicians got, you know, found drugs as a way of kind of insulating that from that or defying it or whatever it might be. I mean, the book's worth reading because you get so much more deeply and nuanced about so much of this. But, you know, the fact of the matter is it was also true of the white jazz musicians. I mean, if I think of the famous, you know, white jazz saxophonists, I mean, you think about not just Stan Getz, but Jerry Mulligan, perhaps the greatest of all, you know, baritone saxophonists, Art Pepper, you know, the vocalist Chet Baker. You think about the singer Anita O'Day. You think about Zoot Sims and Al Cohn and Red Rodney. Even Drift, I'd think, because there's a more of a theme around race there. But just say a little more about that experience of the white jazz musicians in all of this.
Well, you know, they were just as prone and just as vulnerable to it. You know, all of the same forces, culturally and musically, were at work on them. And they were, you know, the brothers and sisters of the black jazz musicians. I mean, they all lived in this world. They all had this experience together. Listen, addiction, it knows no race. It knows no socioeconomic level. I mean, it's just, it's human. I mean, this is fundamentally a human experience. It's not racial. It's not musical. It's not white. It's just fundamentally human. And it knows no bounds. Listen, and it wasn't just white jazz musicians. I mean, the white community of jazz lovers, the hipsters, you know, they were just as prone to, you know, the use of the drugs and the possibility of addiction as, you know, anyone who was black.
So, Martin, listen, I mean, I've loved our conversation. I hope for our listeners that for those of you already into jazz, you'll track down and listen to some of those songs that we play clips of and some of the other references. So, Martin, thank you ever so much for joining me and my listeners on Psychoactive.
Thank you, Ethan, and all the best to you and all the work that you do.
If you're enjoying Psychoactive, please tell your friends about it. Or you can write us a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners. If you'd like to share your own stories, comments, and ideas, then leave us a message at 1-833-779-2460. That's 833-PSYCHO-0. Or you can email us at psychoactive@protozoa.com or find me on Twitter at Ethan Nadelman. You can also find contact information in our show notes. Psychoactive is a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. It's hosted by me, Ethan Nadelman. It's produced by Noam Osband and Josh Thane. The executive producers are Dylan Golden, Ari Handel, Elizabeth Giesis, and Darren Aronofsky from Protozoa Pictures, Alex Williams and Matt Frederick from iHeartRadio, and me, Ethan Nadelman. Our music is by Ari Belusian. And a special thanks to Avivit Bar-Yosef, Bianca Grimshaw, and Robert Beebe. Next week, I'll be talking with the founder of National Advocates for Pregnant Women. Her name's Lynn Paltrow, and she's the leading advocate at the intersection of drug policy reform and reproductive rights.
I once got a call from a drug testing representative on his way to a hospital. And he said, I'm going up to talk to this hospital and I want to convince them to use our drug test because it'll help them treat pregnant women. I was like, no, it won't. It will be used to turn those women over to police or punitive civil child welfare folks and used against them.
Subscribe to Psychoactive now so you don't miss it.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid Kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Health Aid Kombucha.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.